welcome everyone to the Battle of Gettysburg podcast. I am your co-host, Eric Lindblade, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, Jim Hessler. Jim, what's tonight's episode?
Thanks, Cousin Eric, and hello again to everybody. This is going to be part two of our special deep dive on the wheat field. Last time we defined the wheat field, we met the Rose family, we met some tenants, we stepped into the ring, and we introduced G.T. Anderson and Regis de Chateaubriand. Now we're going to come out of their corners, and they're going to go into battle in the bloody wheat field itself for what we're calling Phase 1 here on Part 2 of the Wheat Field on the bloody Battle of Gettysburg podcast. Jody, as I turn it over to you, I think we have a special milestone episode we're recording here. You want to talk a little bit about that and where we're recording from today?
That's right. We're recording again from Getty's Gear. And this is our golden episode. It is our 50th.
50 episodes.
50. I feel proud.
I do. 50 episodes. Who would have thunk it?
You know, the naysayers said it couldn't be done, that we would not make it this far. And here we are, 50.
50 and more planned.
50 more, maybe.
Well, we should point out, too, not only are we re-recording at Getty's Gear, but because this is our 50th episode, Eric, you and I are donned in our tuxedos today. Jody, you look very dazzling in your evening gown. We've got the champagne on ice. I think the proper atmosphere here to really dive into the wheat field.
Will there be salad with that champagne?
Is it going to really be salad, though?
Well, I mean,
that's what they're calling it, right?
Exactly. That's what a bad woman calls making salad, right?
Yes. Salad. Well, wasn't that what Mrs. Sickles, yes, and Mr. Key were enjoying?
Yeah, actually.
Champagne and salad. I was trying to do a callback.
No, I know. That's what I thought we were talking about.
In the parlor on the couch.
Yeah, that's what I thought we were talking about. See, what I was thinking now, if this is our golden episode, we should just phone this one in. Do like a clips episode. Play highlights from previous installments. Get to the wheat field some other time.
I mean, no, it's very fitting. I mean, Sickles is already making an appearance. One and a half last time. How many will he make this time?
An onslaught of Sickles here on our 50th installment.
We could do that.
But we won't.
But that is what separates us from other shows.
All right.
So we're going to delve right into the
wheat field.
We're
going to give the people what they want. Huge positive reaction to the wheat field part one, and this one is really going to be now the blood and the guts as we get into combat.
As we embark on episode 50, it is a new year, a new season, and we also would like to welcome a brand new sponsor to the show. Jody, tell our superfans about our new sponsor.
Yes, we have a new sponsor. Their name is Research Arsenal, and you'll be hearing a lot more about them in the upcoming episodes and on other platforms. However, just a few things to get you excited. They have over 10,000 photos that are keyword searchable, 30,000 plus letters, and 4,000 plus ordnance records. Not too shabby.
No, and these are all primary source documents that will help you as you do research. So we will be telling you a lot more and actually using some of what they have as we put together our episodes. So once again, we'd like to welcome our friends at Research Arsenal, and we hope that you will support them and check them out. They do some great work, and we're happy to have them on board. All that said, with enough of us patting ourselves on the back, let's move into the wheat field. So, Jim, catch the listeners up to where we left things off in part one.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So, in part one, we defined the boundaries, mm-hmm, of the wheat field. We decided that the wheat field is the wheat field. And to make a long story short, basically the Rose Farm itself.
We drew some lines, too.
We did draw some lines. The wheat field road is going to be one, mm-hmm, boundary. The Rose Farm, obviously Stony Hill is included. Hell, I'm not going to go through the boundaries again, folks. Go back and listen to part one if you need a refresher. But we're in the wheat field and we're on the Rose Farm. And that's the important part.
So where we left off, we had Regis de Chateaubriand's brigade moving into the wheat field proper. Yes. We also had the Georgia Brigade under George Anderson beginning their advance to ultimately engaging with that brigade in the wheat field. And that's where we left things off. So not a shot has really been fired. Maybe a couple stray shots from the 17th Maine towards Anderson's men advancing. But right now, nothing has really flared up yet in the wheat field. Yes.
Okay. And we met Anderson and de Chateaubriand. We did some brief bios so people know who they are. Jody, did you have any thoughts?
So we've had some feedback from listeners about the 99th PA. Jim drew the line there. He was very adamant.
No. 99th PA. No.
Sorry, 99th PA.
That will be for our 100th Devil's Den episode.
There you go. And also the 20th Indiana is our left boundary, correct?
Yes.
those fighting Hoosiers, yes, from the 20th Indiana.
So why don't we start there? So we have Anderson advancing. We have Anderson's brigade, Georgia Brigade, advancing. As we talked about last time, they're going to move quickly and in good order. They're going to cross the Emmitsburg Road. They're going to start to come in that direction. But before they have stepped off, to your point, Jody, we want to remember that as part of Longstreet's attack, Robertson's brigade had gone prior to Anderson. And Robertson's brigade is primarily hunkered down in and around Hawks Ridge, Devil's Den, and where we drew our right boundary on the Confederate side last time is we're going to start with the 3rd Arkansas.
And I think what confuses folks, I think the issue with the 99th Pennsylvania, had they remained where they were originally positioned, they would be part of our story. They would be right there, but they get shifted more into the Devil's Den area, so they leave the scene. So yes, you might look at maps of the opening phases and see the 99th Pennsylvania there, but keep in mind, it's a cup of coffee in the big time. They are heading back to the Devil's Den in a few moments.
Look, had they realized they would be excluded from the 50th episode of the Battle of Gettysburg podcast, they might have stayed in position. We can't be responsible for that.
Choices have consequences.
3rd Arkansas. Okay, the 3rd Arkansas. They are hunkered down in and around Hawks Ridge. Now, the 3rd Arkansas, I have a little thumbnail bio. Nothing too detailed, but just a little thumbnail sketch on a lot of people involved today. 3rd Arkansas, they hearken back to 1861, and they have these great Confederate company nicknames like the Berlin Beauregards, the Hot Spring Hornets, and the Tulip Rifles. They're commanded by Colonel Van H. Manning, which I always thought was one of our cooler Confederate names.
Yeah, that's a good
right?
name.
Van Manning. What do you think of that, Jody?
It's a very cool name. It's a stage name.
So it's a ring name.
It's a ring name.
It's a ring name.
I could see, Van Manning doing well in Mid-South.
Yeah, if he's entering the steel cage. There you go.
Well, and also he's in Arkansas, so he has to be the Mid-South territory.
Well, we're talking about that. So is he maybe coming into the cage and smashing the folding chair over somebody's head, maybe?
The Frenchman.
Exactly.
Stay tuned. It writes itself.
Okay, so Manning, born in 1839 in Wake County, North Carolina.
Yes, he is.
So we have another North Carolinian on the show. And that would make him a few weeks shy of his 24th birthday at the Battle of Gettysburg. So all joking aside, think about that. This 24-year-old kid leading this regiment into action against, what it would probably initially appear to be an entrenched Union position on Hawks Ridge. Okay, so real quick, Manning moved as a child in 1841 to Mississippi. He attended school in the Delta. He then went to the University of Nashville in Tennessee, so he moves again, where he studied law. After graduation, he and his wife moved to Arkansas in 1860, and that's ultimately how he gets associated with the state of Arkansas. He was admitted to the bar in 61, and he practiced a little bit of law, which seems to be a common thing in these regimental commanders in the Army of Northern Virginia. We seem to have a lot of hired lawyers and politicians and stuff like that in the ranks.
And we have the same in the Army of the Potomac,
too.
You see them. And I think, as much as people like to make fun of lawyers, it does translate well. I mean, you have to be very clear when you are making legal arguments. Same thing if you're trying to make an order on a battlefield. So there's some advantages there. Some disadvantages as well. But
Daniel E. Sickles, Esquire.
Yes.
Attorney at law.
Our finest attorney on the battlefield.
That's right. And we should argue the staff attorney for the Battle of the
Gettysburg. He is indeed.
All right. Now, real quick on Manning, and then we'll move on. One of the things, if you read Manning's report on the Battle of Gettysburg, he is one of several Confederate commanders, whether they be brigade commanders or in some case at the regimental level, but Manning's one of several commanders on that part of the field. First of all, he talks about specifically having to pull away from the Emmitsburg Road based on the direction of attack that has been established by Law's brigade as they move to the Round Tops. But then he also talks about, too, a lack of support on his left. Because whether it's intentional or not, the way these Confederate brigades are stepping off, Confederate right to left, one at a time, is leaving all of these guys going into action with no support on their left. And Manning is one of the guys who's going to talk about this. He's going to, as we've said, get hunkered down in front of Hawks Ridge. We'll bring the 17th Maine into it. But this is also on the Confederate side going to leave an opportunity for G.T. Anderson's brigade to step in and help out.
What you see are a number of regiments, very similar to the 3rd Arkansas, facing a similar decision like that. Do you move more to the area towards Devil's Den, or are you now moving more towards where you're receiving fire in the area around the wheat field? It's a tough choice to make. And what we're beginning to see is this attack is, even at its regimental level, starting to begin to bog down. We're starting to get some delays here and there, some greater than others, but that's going to kind of be the story of July 2nd is there is support, but are they going to arrive in time? Are they going to arrive when you need them? And are you even able to see them at times? And think about one area that I think a lot of folks do not explore around the wheat field is the area where the 3rd Arkansas would have been fighting. And if you ever really move into that area, and I would recommend doing it in the winter when things kind of freeze over a little bit. Don't try to do this in August, folks. But it's pretty marshy. It's rugged. It's a tough area to have to get through. And that's also going to cause further really disorganization and issues in the ranks.
It's also got that famous ledge of rocks, which the 3rd Arkansas is going to get kind of behind the ledge of rocks, opposite the position held by the Hoosiers of the 20th Indiana, who we established is going to kind of be our Union left boundary today.
And I think it's important, too, like if you've ever walked across that, we're thinking, oh, they're coming under fire, they're getting disorderly. But no, a lot of it is the terrain as you're walking across.
We always recommend walking the battlefield as best you can. Follow the advances as best you can. And if you are just sticking to the park roads around the wheat field, you're not going to really get a sense of the terrain and the issues that those fighting in are going to have. And so I would recommend if you ever kind of go down, really even use the old trolley path if you want. That's a good way to kind of get, if you want an easy path to sort of see that, follow the trolley path. That'll give you a good sense of that kind of undulating terrain, also how really marshy it is through that area. So not only do you have rocks, you have underbrush, you have marshy terrain. This is not easy for not only the 3rd Arkansas, but soon, as we're going to see, Anderson and his men.
Yeah, and before we bring Anderson into the field, I want to make sure we don't forget the 20th Indiana. So should we just bring them on a little bit? So the 20th Indiana, Colonel John Wheeler, and that's a name we sometimes hear in association with the Wheeler Rock and things of that nature. But if you notice, even when you read Second Day books or the few Wheatfield-centric books that are out there, you don't often hear a lot about Wheeler, the individual. So I just wanted to touch on him a little bit. And Eric, I know you've got some interesting facts about the regiment itself. John Wheeler's 20th Indiana. Now, remember, the 20th Indiana is part of Ward's Brigade. This is the end of that extension along the Devil's Den, Hawks Ridge area. 20th Indiana is going to bring about 400 men onto the field here on July 2nd at Gettysburg. About 400 guys, roughly about 156 casualties, which will lead a 39% casualty rate. Unfortunately, Colonel John Wheeler is going to be one of those casualties. Now, Wheeler was 38 years old at the Battle of Gettysburg, born in 1825. He had been born in Connecticut, but he had moved to Indiana in 1847. Farmer, teacher, county surveyor, and ran a newspaper. So again, a guy with a lot of distinguished accomplishments kind of in the background. Now, he had raised the local company, was elected captain, and then eventually that company got rolled into the 20th Indiana. Photos of John Wheeler show a guy with a flowing dark beard and really some stern eyes. Wheeler looks like a guy that knew his stuff and you probably didn't want to mess with a little bit. But he was promoted to colonel. He led the regiment in Chancellorsville. Today, there is a Colonel Wheeler Middle School in Crown Point, Indiana. So I wanted to give a shout out to our tens of thousands of listeners in Crown Point, Indiana, where it is a great day to be a bulldog, is what the middle school says on their website. So welcome to everybody from Crown Point.
Should we just call him John the Bulldog Wheeler?
I like it. Everybody's got a ring name.
There we go. We got the Bulldog.
We got the Bulldog coming into the ring to help out the Trubriand, who's about to get hit in the head with the folding chair. I mean, this is just coming together, right? Of course, too, is battlefield guides. One of the great scavenger hunt items on this part of the field is the Wheeler Rock, which is a couple yards away from the 20th Indiana Monument. Eric, you had some interesting factoids we were talking about on the regiment itself.
Yeah, the 20th Indiana has if you ever look at the battle honors of some of these units, every now and then you see some battles that really sort of jump out at you. And one of the ones that if you ever look at the 20th Indiana's battle honors, you will see is the Battle of Hampton Roads. Now people are thinking, wait a minute, Hampton Roads, that's the USS Monitor, that's the CSS Virginia, that's a naval battle. What does a infantry regiment from Indiana have to do with that? Well, keep in mind, when that engagement was taking place, there were Union infantry regiments, artillery batteries, as well as Confederate around the area around Hampton Roads. And at one point, the 20th Indiana will actually open fire towards the CSS Virginia. So here we have these guys fighting in and around the Wheatfield area who would have actually qualified to be part of a naval battle in the American Civil War. So, you know, I think kind of a neat little star to put beside them, a unique feature of that regiment.
Very cool. So two companies of the 20th Indiana are originally in advance as skirmishers, and they're going to be the first ones to face off with the 3rd Arkansas in and around this Ledge of Rocks area. They're going to exchange a volley or two. The skirmishers are going to keep up a relatively steady fire before falling back onto the main line. Unfortunately, though, as the 3rd Arkansas kind of gets embedded in and around these rocks, Colonel Wheeler, who's going to be riding behind the lines trying to encourage and steady the men, is going to be shot through the temple and killed. Thus, again, we have the Wheeler Rock on the battlefield today, which is supposed to commemorate the approximate location of about where that happened. So when you hire licensed battlefield guides, wink, wink, we'll come out, we'll show you where the Wheeler Rock is one of the landmarks in the wheat field.
And already the battle has just really commenced, and we're already starting to take heavy losses among Union leadership.
Yeah.
I mean, here's a steady colonel that's now taken out of the fight. And we're going to see this recurring quite a bit with a number of the officers that are at the brigade and regimental level in the Wheatfield.
Yeah, even within the regiment, Lieutenant Colonel Taylor is then going to take over, but he's going to be wounded. And so then a command is going to fall to a captain by the name of Erasmus Gilbrath. And the captain actually tried to mount Wheeler's horse. Wheeler's horse was spooked from all the gunfire and the shooting, and the spooked animal ran away. And that's kind of sad. Jody, you're
that
a horse person. You like horses.
Yeah, I do like horses. All that carnage and the horse runs away and then...
That's sad. That's sad.
And you can understand why a horse would probably do that with intense fighting that's taking place at that point. And think about the issues of now you're having essentially a captain trying to lead a regiment into this terrain. This isn't open field maneuvering. This is a tough situation.
No,
not only that,
easy.
They're up against some pretty tough troops. This is not an easy day at the office for these men from Indiana.
Yeah, and so the part of this story that I've always found interesting is the captain then sends a message back to General Ward, basically saying, hey, Colonel Wheeler has been killed, and I think the captain is kind of looking for some hand-holding, some assistance, directions, something from the brigade level. And Ward sends a message back that basically says, quote, hello, Gilbrath. I'm sorry Wheeler is gone, but as you are in command, General Ward directs me to say that you must hold this line as long as you can, using the ammunition of the killed or the wounded, and when you can stay no longer, fall back towards the small cabin we passed on the way in. So imagine the guy's, General Ward, sending that through a staff officer, is basically saying, no, you're going to stay, and you're going to use all the ammunition you can.
No advice, no mount. And a lot of times they would be on mounts to get respect and command, and people could see who's commanding them at that time. And bad terrain.
Yeah.
Bad day for 20th Indiana.
And think about the quote, until all of your ammunition is gone and using what's around you.
Right.
Think about the average Civil War soldier, 40 to 60 rounds, 2 to 3 shots a minute. You're looking at 20, 30 minutes in your cartridge box, whatever anybody else has left. So really, you're looking at maybe a 30 to 40 minute ability to fight. One of the things that has always fascinated me about the Wheatfield, and there's parts of this battle I think we'll never get the answers to, because things are not always written down. How the heck do they keep resupplying everybody in the Wheatfield?
Yeah.
That's one of the great questions I have, is how do they keep this ammunition flowing? Because you hear about these units just keep fighting and fighting and fighting. Well, they've got to keep getting resupplied. And that's a great, you know, if anybody wants to do the deep dive into research, there's an interesting study right there.
Well, that's a great point. And I think with the wheat field in the back and the fourth, that's going to turn out to be one of the reasons why ultimately so many regiments do fall back. You know, when we try to recreate it as historians or armchair generals, we're often assuming it's heavy fire and chaos or panic or whatever is going on. And I think to that point, a lot of times it's just, no, we're out of ammunition. We got to go.
Do you really want to be taking ammunition off your comrades? Or no.
That's not a fun situation.
No, it's not.
And not only that, it's also wounded. And right. I'm sure as you're helping get that cartridge box, help me out. Help, pull me out of here. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I've got to get back to the firing line. And I think we don't often think about that aspect of these battles, that we just assume the soldiers get where they need to go. They have what they need to fight, and they have what they need to live. We don't really ever think about what it takes to actually ensure that happens. And to me, the fact that these guys were just being supplied logistically to the way they were is pretty remarkable. And there's certainly, I think, a fascinating but untold story probably sitting there.
Yeah. Now, in the segue here, Jody said it's a bad day for the 20th Indiana. But remember, things are not going well for the 3rd Arkansas either. Because while this is happening, de Trobriand has put the 17th Maine along that stone wall on the edge of the wheat field specifically to fire into the left flank of these advancing Confederates. So Colonel Manning has initially refused a couple of the left companies of the 3rd Arkansas. But finally, we're going to get to it, folks. G.T. Anderson's brigade arrives on the scene. And that initial regiment on Anderson's right is going to be the 59th Georgia. And they're going to help shore up and support the left of the 3rd Arkansas. Now, initially, guys, remember, Anderson's brigade is double-quicked from the Emmitsburg Road. So they've done, you know, they're initially a little tired and winded themselves. Some of the reports talk about taking artillery fire as they're crossing this open field under a broiling sun.
Wait, they didn't just walk up the Emmitsburg Road?
Exactly. No, they didn't.
Let's point that out.
No, they didn't. So they've double-quicked across the road. 59th now goes onto the flank of the 3rd Arkansas, and eventually that moment of running out of ammunition for the 20th Indiana is going to happen, and the captain is going to tell the regiment basically to fall back.
And this is a good way of in any part of this battle or a Civil War battle, people sometimes get hung up on time. Does this happen at 4:30? Does this happen at 5 o'clock? One of the great things we can look at, one of the best ways to tell time on a battlefield is using these cartridge boxes as your means of telling time, that a lot of the fighting at this battle, 20, 30 minutes. If you really kind of delve into it all across the field. So this is a common situation. And when we look at the wheat field, there's the idea of it changing hands so many times. But as I've really begun to kind of delve into it, what is interesting is how you have this sort of shift in manpower. Mm-hmm. When you think for this moment, when the 3rd Arkansas is taking on the 20th Indiana and parts of the 17th Maine, they're outnumbered. But now the 59th Georgia comes in, Anderson comes in, the tide now shifts to the Confederates. We're going to see it shifting back to the Union Army in a little bit, but it's kind of not only do you have the field changing hands, but you also have the numbers of these sides shifting at times. So 1 minute you might think you might have a numerical advantage, very soon after it's gone.
Well, you know, that's the thing too. We've talked about it. We've talked about it with listeners as we're getting into this wheat field deep dive. Everybody's obsessed with how many times did the wheat field change hands? What's the number? What number are Jim, Eric, and Jody going to come up with and that sort of thing? I don't personally care what a number is, but it's the characteristic of the fighting which is much more interesting to me, and that's this back and forth nature that we're talking about. And that's, to me, that's what the wheat field really is. I don't care if it's four times, six times, three times, but this back and forth is what we see, which is characteristic of the wheat field, maybe more than any other part of the Gettysburg battlefield. Now, there's a story when the 20th is falling back, Southern fire concentrated on the Hoosiers' colors, and the color bearer was felled by a bullet through the leg, but a young corporal grabbed the colors, saved the flag, and got it off the field. But Gilbreth recalled that the rebels laughed when the Indiana colors fell to the ground.
That's not nice.
That's just unchivalrous. I'm sorry. Eric's speechless.
Got anything, Eric?
Well, the idea of laughter, it reminds me of actually a battle that I know a good bit about, the Battle of Newport Barracks. And at one point, they discussed in the battle that Union veterans were laughing at the green troops who were kind of dodging bullets. So it's not uncommon to hear laughter on a battlefield, even though it seems completely out of place, but in stress, people do weird things. Have you ever met somebody that laughs when they're stressed or uncomfortable? You're going to be uncomfortable, bullets whizzing by your head.
So you're saying it's nervous laughter. They're not
I think it could very well be nervous laughter.
As I always say.
Or just mocking Indians.
Yes, as I always say, the way we're nervously and uncomfortably laughing right now, talking about a heavy topic, laughter is always a good medicine, even in these stressful times.
Yeah, I think people would read that and go, well, they're laughing. It's not that uncommon, though, if you really look at some of the experiences of soldiers in combat.
I just thought I'd throw that out there because it's a good story. All right, I got a thumbnail on the 59th Georgia. Okay, 59th Georgia. They are the right of G.T. Anderson's brigade. 525 men. They will come in at 142 casualties, which will be a 27% casualty rate. Now, the 59th Georgia is led here at Gettysburg by Colonel Jack Brown, who will actually be wounded and captured during the fighting here, and he won't be exchanged until March of 1864. And again, just sort of a little factoid here, the 59th Georgia had been put into the brigade in, I think, about 62 or so to replace the 1st Kentucky, which at one time was part of the brigade and ultimately got transferred elsewhere before they mustered out in 1862. So that's just my fun factoid on the 59th Georgia.
There we go. We could have had Kentucky soldiers. Although, interestingly enough, there are a number of Kentucky soldiers in the 3rd Arkansas.
Yeah, exactly.
I believe it's company, I want to say H, some letter of the alphabet. But you do have a contingent of Kentuckians in the 3rd Arkansas.
Maybe they were the ones laughing.
And sometimes we do get questions, were there any Kentucky troops in this battlefield? And we have to unfortunately say, no, there were not organized Kentucky units, but we do have Kentuckians on the field, as well as Kentuckians serving in various companies.
But now, after listening to this installment of the Battle of Gettysburg podcast, when you get that family from Kentucky who wants to see where their ancestors fought, people can now take them to the Ledge of Rocks.
Yes, where everyone wants to visit here. I mean, it's Devil's Den, it's the High Water Mark, it's Little Round Top, and the Ledge of Rocks. It's in that order.
Okay, so other units are continuing to move in. So remember, as we've said, the Confederates are stepping off from their right to their left. So progressively, we see more Confederate units coming in on the Confederate left. And obviously, then that is hitting some corresponding units who are opposite them on the Union side. So we talked about the 17th Maine against the Stonewall. And I think we mentioned their monument a little bit in part one. Again, I'll say again, it's one of my favorite monuments on the battlefield. Whenever I take my tours out to the wheat field, I use the 17th Maine Monument all the time to illustrate the idea of the soldiers behind this stone wall. 17th Maine, they were mostly regiments from the western part of the state of Maine, came up here with about 350 men and 133 casualties, which will be a 38% casualty rate under Lieutenant Colonel Charles Merrill. Now, de Trobriand talks about placing them behind the stone wall in his report. And if you may indulge me, de Trobriand says, quote, "The accustomed yells of the Confederates and the intensity of the firing on my left had scarcely announced the precise point and the violence of the attack. When I extended my right by moving the 17th Maine Volunteers, Lieutenant Colonel Merrill, across a wheat field in order to fill an open gap there, thereby reinforcing General Ward. The 17th Maine took a strong position behind a stone wall and did good service at this point."
So what we're looking at now, the 3rd Arkansas is continuing in their engagement. The 59th Georgia has moved to their support. Moving to the left of the 59th Georgia is the 11th Georgia. To the left of the 11th Georgia is the 8th Georgia. And to the left of the 8th Georgia is the 9th Georgia. All moving through that rough, rugged terrain towards what we would consider today kind of the wheat field part of the wheat field, if that makes sense.
The actual wheat field.
The actual wheat field in the wheat field, yes.
Yeah, so think about it. They're coming from the Emmitsburg Road. They're hitting the edge of Rose's Woods and then going into the wheat field itself. Okay, so Eric told you next to the 59th Georgia is the 11th Georgia. 309 men, 201 casualties, 65% under Colonel Francis Little, who was also going to be wounded in this engagement. Now, the 11th Georgia was another one that went back to the spring of 61. They had mustered into service in July. They'd been recruited from several counties in Georgia. And if you remember from part one, the 11th Georgia was the old regiment of that time Captain George T. Anderson. So we mentioned the 11th Georgia last time, that this was Anderson's old unit. But at Gettysburg, Major Henry McDowell of the 11th, so he reported that upon reaching a belt of woods, which we know today as Rose's Woods, a vigorous fire was opened from the enemy, following by a charge on our part, which ultimately dislodged the enemy from the woods, the ravine, which would probably be Plum Run, and a stone fence running diagonally with the line of battle. So we actually have an account of the 11th going up against what he calls this stone fence. And he's probably telescoped some of the events there, but at least, again, it gives you an idea what the officer, the men of the 11th Georgia experienced as they were coming up against the stone wall.
And the conditions in that area make it difficult to really just sort of push immediately against an opponent. And what I think you have is there is a little bit of a timidness as you're sort of probing, seeing what's in front of you, not trying to get yourself into a situation. That sort of slowing of the momentum, when we think of almost an entire brigade moving in right now, you're thinking, gosh, on paper, this is not going to end well for de Trobriand's men. But they do have some things going for them. They're on relatively higher ground. They do have in their front that kind of broken terrain. And the Confederates are not fully aware or sure of what is in their front. This is all going to contribute to helping these Union defenders at really this critical point when, really on paper and position-wise, they should have been in a world of hurt.
I mean, you're right, Eric. And so next to the 11th Georgia, we're now bringing, as you said, the 8th and the 9th Georgia online. So the 8th Georgia has got about 311 men under Colonel John Towers, who, again, will also be wounded. So you guys starting to notice a theme here? All of the regimental commanders killed, wounded, captured. Colonel Towers of the 8th Georgia, he will be one of the 168th casualties in the regiment for a 54% casualty rate. What I like about Towers is he's one of these guys who's been wounded actually in several engagements, including Gettysburg. And that always tells me this is a guy who led from the front and was doing what he needed to be doing. But he's going to survive all the way to Appomattox. The 8th Georgia had been with Anderson's brigade since 1862. And then on their left is, last but not least, is the 9th Georgia, which really has kind of a similar bio to the 8th. But Lieutenant Colonel John Monger led the 9th Georgia. He's going to bring about 340 men onto the field, 189 casualties for a 56% casualty rate, and Lieutenant Colonel Monger is going to be killed here on the field. And there's a story about that. Monger had been the lieutenant colonel since April of 62. He'd been wounded at 2nd Manassas and at Sharpsburg and had reportedly intended to resign due to poor health and return to Georgia. Now, he's got a couple sons in the regiment, and unfortunately, the lieutenant colonel is killed while leading his men in these fields past the Emmitsburg Road, killed by a gunshot and a shell fragment through the bowels, which, you know, has got to be, yeah, it's got to be deadly. And the Mongers had already lost one of their sons at Chancellorsville. They had two sons in the regiment who then had to write their mother about their dad's death here on the Gettysburg battlefield. But he was originally buried near Whistler's blacksmith shop before being exhumed to the Laurel Grove Cemetery in Savannah in 1871, where he rests today. And I want to give a quick shout out, if I could, to our friend Richard Michael Allen. I called him Richard Charles Allen in part one. He's actually got a different middle name.
Well, he has aliases.
Exactly.
I mean, he is from Baltimore.
Parts unknown.
Parts unknown, right. Sometimes if necessary.
Which is a good example why, look, we know him as Rick Allen. When you write a book, just go by the name everybody knows you as. I don't even know what Eric and Jody's middle names are. How was I going to get Richard Michael Allen's middle name right? But I do want to give him a shout out, all joking aside, for the great brigade history he's done of Anderson's brigade. As I said in part one, if you're interested, you should try to find a copy, which is probably now kind of scarce.
So at this point, most of Anderson's men are either 30% or over 50% gone within, what, the opening 30 to 40 minutes, if that?
Yeah, I would think most of the casualties they probably suffer are in this initial phase, for lack of a better term. And once again, this is part and parcel of the wheat field. I remember there's one description of the wheat field, and I'm sort of paraphrasing here, that it was like a whirlpool that sucked units in and spit out their remains. This is a good example of that. These regiments that are entering at relatively decent strength. I mean, the 59th Georgia's got 500 guys. We've got a couple over 300 here. And in a matter of moments, they are going to lose pretty heavily here.
Yeah. And if you're a new study and you're looking at, like you said, the maps, it looks like they have the advantage. However, with the terrain, it's leaving a lot of their flanks open. It's allowing them to take a lot of fire when on paper or flat paper, it doesn't look like they would.
That's an excellent point, I think. For many of us, we view the Battle of Gettysburg two-dimensionally. Mm-hmm. We're looking at the Lano campaign atlas or whatever map you're using. Books cannot translate to what terrain is like when you're actually out there. And I always recommend, as much as you can, take these sources out to the field itself. See what the soldiers are seeing. See what the commanders are seeing. It will really enhance your understanding of the battle. There are plenty of people that can memorize these maps, the order of battle, all of this, but could not tell you the first thing about how the ebb and flow of this battle actually took place. So it's important to consider that this is a three-dimensional event, not two-dimensional as we often view it on the maps.
Yeah, and I'll advocate for any battlefield on that.
Absolutely.
You never understand any battlefield until you get on the ground, and certainly Gettysburg, with the size and the scale and the complexity, is a good candidate for that, no doubt.
And I hope this series we're doing will inspire people to really wander around the wheat field more than maybe they have in the past, go to some of these out-of-the-way places, and by doing so, get a better understanding of what happened. And I'm going to say it right now, at the end of this series, I think people will understand the wheat field. I think they will by the end of this.
I agree. And I hope not only do they understand the wheat field, but I'm doing some of these thumbnail bios here because I want to make sure people understand the people involved.
Yes.
And that, again, it's not just, like you said, looking at the Lano map and, okay, the 59th, the 11th, the 8th, and the 9th. Well, so what? Who were these guys? Mm-hmm. Where were they from? How many of them? Did they have families? And I hope, too, by listening to some of this, you know, obviously, we can't cover everybody, but when we announced this on social media and a lot of people were like, hey, don't forget my regiment or my favorite regiment or my reenacting unit. So I'm literally trying to come through here with at least one thumbnail on every regiment so that people know not only what block were they on the Lano map, but a little bit more about who they were and where they were from.
And when's the last time someone's talked about the 59th Georgia?
Right.
Ever. So I think what we hope is that maybe you might hear something that go, that's really interesting. Let me dig more into that. This is how we learn, folks. It's not just regurgitating information that people have already put out there. It's delving in and learning new things and taking what you have and using that as a foundation. And I think this is going to be what I'm really excited about with this, is that we are giving attention to units and individuals that I cannot remember the last time I have seen a mention of some of these units, which is, it's nice to give them that attention they deserve.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, both of you touched on the back and forth. You know, some accounts have the 8th Georgia advancing, falling back, and advancing again as many as three times. Now, one officer in the 8th Georgia wrote, quote, "Our lines did not waver under the galling musketry, but came on almost at a run, firing vigorously. I've never read in military history of any soldiers who could deliver such deadly volleys as ours when charging. We were soon ranged along our side of the bog." So there's something that, you know, we've talked about the terrain and how marshy and all of that is. Some of these guys literally talk about it as being a bog, almost like quicksand, that at some point guys are stuck into waist deep. I mean, that's how mucky this area of the battlefield was.
And you can see that if you wander down the trolley path. Yeah. I mentioned, just look on each side of it. It looks almost like a swamp after a good rain and such. So, yeah, that's really, this is a part of the field that probably has not changed very much from what it looked like in 1863.
And because it's so boggy down there, most people don't walk down there.
Yeah, as I said earlier, I would not recommend doing that in the summer. I would do that after you get a good freeze, because there's parts in the summer you're going to have a hard time getting to without, you know, truly waders or knee boots. It's that thick out there.
And if they're out there and during those three charges, where are they getting resupplied? Mm-hmm.
I think that's all coming from basically Seminary Ridge. And the Emmitsburg Road is where you're going to have to be funneling all of that ammunition from. So, as I said earlier, that is an underappreciated aspect of how you just get ammunition to these troops in the field consistently.
in Gettysburg, that's one of the problems with Longstreet's assault, July 2nd assault in general, just this idea of more or less outrunning your supports.
Yeah.
Now, back to the bog, though, the idea being, yeah, we've seen it when it's been pretty bad. Well, we've got accounts saying during the Battle of Gettysburg that at some points it was waist deep. Uh-huh. So Sergeant Felix King of the 8th Georgia was supposedly mortally wounded crossing this swamp when he got mired in waist deep. He was struck down as he struggled to keep the colors above the muck. And then another soldier who died in it was so deeply embedded that supposedly his body wouldn't even fall over after death. So, I mean, we've seen it in bad condition, but I don't know that I've ever seen it like that.
I've never seen it where it would be waist deep, but I've definitely seen it where it's, you know, at least up to my shins.
Yeah, yeah.
But...
Well, think about it. And if the average guy during the Civil War is only, you know, 5'6", 5'8", 5'9", yeah, maybe.
Feeling tall all of a sudden.
Shin level for us could have been waist deep for some of these guys. Think about that, folks. So anyways, okay, so we talked about the 9th Georgia being Anderson's leftmost regiment. Now, their men were taking a heavy fire as they start to advance on their front and left. We really haven't brought in the Union side of this, which is going to be more of de Trobriand's guys and some of Burling's guys. We'll talk about that in a minute. But the 9th Georgia is notable just for one thing, because since all the superior officers of higher rank were either killed, wounded, Captain George Hillier ends up being in charge of the regiment for a lot of this. And I'm bringing up George Hillier because we know on this podcast the historiography and the source material is important to us. Captain Hillier, who will survive the Battle of Gettysburg, is going to be a guy who, from the Confederate perspective, writes about this action as much as anybody else that I can think of. So if you want to know your source material, you should know George Hillier, and he is a captain in the 9th Georgia that is making this assault. So Hillier basically tried to order his left companies to refuse their flanks, again, basically to address some fire he's taking on his left. But Hillier said it was so loud that the men could not even hear voice commands. So Hillier's got to run to the left of the line, and as he did so, he touched the men on the backs and basically just managed the movements by signs. So not only are we talking about the terrain, you guys, but think about how loud and chaotic it just had to be out there.
Well, we mentioned in the first episode that it's sort of the wheat field, when you're in it, sort of the bottom of a punch bowl. And we, of course, rechristened it a steel cage. But what you have is in these little pockets, it creates acoustically these sort of little valleys where the sound just hangs. And yeah, if you're getting all those regiments in close proximity pouring fire into each other, it's going to be incredibly loud. And once again, here is an example of no verbal commands. Simply touching guys on the back, getting them to move. I think that gives you a sense of what the nature of the fighting in and around the wheat field really is. We know it's bad, but we never really fully appreciate just how bad it actually is.
Yeah, you know, and that's not going to be the last time you'll hear somebody in the wheat field saying that it was so loud we couldn't hear anything around us. That's not the only time. George Hillier, 28 years old at Gettysburg, commands Company C. Just a couple of things. Again, he was from a prominent family. He was well-educated. At 21, he ran for a seat in the state legislature, and he was elected to the Georgia House of Representatives in 1856, where he served a two-year term. He then went on as clerk of the Georgia House from 1859 to 1860. So again, we see the prominence of the officers and these guys who raised companies at the beginning of the war. So at the outbreak of the Civil War, Hillier raised a company from Walton County. Eric, Jody, how many listeners do we have in Walton County, Georgia? Tens of thousands, I'm thinking?
I'm sure.
At a minimum.
But if we don't, we will now.
And guess what his company was known as? The Hillier Rifles. So the men were mustered into the Confederate Army with Hillier elected captain of, again, what became Company C of the 9th Georgia. We already talked about the idea that with all of the senior officers killed or wounded, he's going to assume command of the regiment for the rest of the Gettysburg campaign. It's Hillier who writes the official report of the 9th Georgia, but he's only going to temporarily command the regiment into August of 63, and then he's going to resign shortly thereafter. So he's not around a whole lot longer after Gettysburg, and for whatever he does at Gettysburg, ultimately does not get the regiment or really any other level of promotion on a full-time basis. Just one quick factoid about him before we move on then. He would go on. He would continue in politics. And maybe you didn't know, maybe you didn't know, he became the 29th mayor of Atlanta, Georgia.
Really?
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. It's a little factoid on Captain Hillier. Now, I've talked to Rick Allen about Hillier many times over the years. As we said, Hillier writes a lot of stuff. And like a lot of people, as Hillier's writings get further and further away from the event, take it a little bit more with a grain of salt. But again, if you want Southern perspectives in the wheat field, he's a guy that's kind of hard to ignore.
And I think it helps that he leaves the army in August of 1863. He will not go through the Overland campaign. He will not go through some of these very bloody campaigns that are coming up, which means that he gets to live and write these accounts, and which is, we laugh at it, but in many ways, history is written by the survivors, not the victors. And for the fact that he is able to survive this conflict, come out of the wheat field relatively unscathed, it allows us to have this great account that we may not have had otherwise if all of a sudden he takes a bullet to the face at the Wilderness.
Oh, God.
Can't argue with that. Living is a good career move.
So with that, where do we have everybody? We have the Georgians. They're coming across. They're at the bog. Are we at the stony fence yet?
Well, we're sort of. I mean, this is the wheat field. Now, I should point out, too, it would help for people, if you want to kind of follow along, because in other complex battle actions we've done in the past, we have referred people to passages in the Leno book. Now, I've got my Leno, I've got the first edition in front of me, so I'm looking at page 196 of the first edition, which is maps 2.54 and 2.55, which is Anderson attacks the wheat field. I don't know, Eric, if you have a different edition there.
Yes. I'm actually looking at the second edition. Looks like some of the titles have been changed slightly.
He did a lot of
but
work.
Yeah, what I would just say, best thing to do, go into your Leno Atlas, whether you have the first or second edition, and just go to the wheat field section and just kind of follow along with us.
Trying to orient everybody. We're trying to bring you along with us.
And I'm not saying this in a joking way. When you see the regiments we're talking about, you know you're in the right place. And we're going to see a lot of units we're going to introduce here in a few moments. But for right now, we're really looking at a situation where it's kind of Anderson against parts of the 20th Indiana, the 17th Maine. The left of Anderson is moving forward, and we are about to get some new additions into the wheat field as well. Some additional Union forces moving in as well. And I think this is a good time to sort of introduce some of those Union units now coming to the support in the wheat field.
You are correct, sir. Agree. So let's meet the Yankee counterparts. Now, if I could, one notable guy that we really haven't mentioned a lot of yet is the artillery support. Mm-hmm. So if we could back up to do Winslow's battery, and then we'll move forward to some of these
There's another kind of constant in the wheat field.
Exactly.
Winslow's guys.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, then we'll come back to the infantry regiments. But, yeah, so to that point, we're going to now pivot over to the Union side. Because really, for what we're doing today for phase one, we've pretty much brought all the Confederates on the field. And to recap, it's Anderson's brigade and the 3rd Arkansas is really the Confederate side. What we're doing today for phase one, artillery. As Eric said, there's one constant in the wheat field, and that's because it's the only battery on either side engaged in this particular action, and that is Captain George Winslow's Battery D, 1st New York Light Artillery. Now, he had been guided into position earlier that afternoon, in part to try to cover gaps that existed between Devil's Den, which would have been on his left, and the Wheatfield Road and the Peach Orchard itself, which would have sort of been to his right in front. When Sickles moved forward and created this salient position, which we all know about, one of the problems they have is this gap that kind of runs between Ward at Devil's Den through the wheat field and then up to the Peach Orchard. Winslow's battery was hoped to address part of that, but the problem is, because he's got Rose's Woods in his front, he really doesn't have a great field of fire. And although he's quote-unquote the only battery in the wheat field, he plays a part. It doesn't play a significant part in the action here, in part because he's got all these trees in front of him. Private John Haley of the 17th Maine, who is at the stone wall down below and kind of in front of Winslow's battery, said that the artillery, quote, was useless as long as the enemy was under cover of the good-sized trees. And basically, at some points, some of these Union veterans kind of ridiculed the artillery as doing nothing more than kind of showering us with branches and leaves and stuff like that.
But they still have canister.
They do, and that's going to come in.
And so keep that in mind, even though what they don't have in their more longer range ordnance, they have plenty of canister, and the fact that you have a smoothbore battery in the middle of the wheat field is something that's going to, at times, draw the attention of the Confederates and not something you want to tangle with directly. So even though maybe the impact of Winslow is not as much as you would think, it does still play a role there. That battery is going to maybe be more of a deterrent than anything else at times.
Yeah, because you don't really see a lot of Confederate accounts saying, too, we got hammered with canister
right.
as we overran this battery. And that's part of it, too.
It almost seems like they take a lot of fire. Just looking at their number of casualties and missing, that's a good number, high number.
Well, you want to tell us about the numbers in the battery?
So it looks like 10 wounded and 8 missing. So
out of 116 men in the battery.
And that's a battery.
For a battery, that's high.
For infantry, we go, oh, that's just another, nothing, that's a skirmish. But for an artillery battery, that's a pretty heavy loss.
Yeah, and I would, you're both right about that. The other thing, too, is, you know, as Eric said, they're smooth bores. They're 6 12-pounders. As I was putting the episode together, this is a good example of every tour I do in the wheat field, Winslow's battery. Here's Winslow's battery. And I'm sure you do, too, and I'm sure every other battlefield guy does, too. It occurred to me as I was putting this together, I didn't know a lot about Winslow, the person.
Mm-hmm.
It just occurred to me, like I mentioned this guy, the wheat field, as far as requests for me, I know you said you get a lot of them. For me, it's probably in my top five because of sickles and peach orchard stuff. But it occurred to me, I didn't know a lot about Winslow, the guy. And what I found out, or what I kind of relearned while doing this, was that basically the battery had been recruited from kind of parts of what I'm going to call northeastern New York, kind of Lewis, Jefferson, St. Lawrence counties, up near Watertown. And I had a family member who once lived in Watertown, so I know exactly where that is. But Winslow had co-raised the battery with another guy that we know, Colonel Thomas W. Osborne, who later goes on to the 11th Corps. And they had raised the battery together. And Winslow was, before the war, a hardware merchant. And again, the two of them had assisted each other in developing the battery. Winslow was considered a magnificent officer, as brave a man as the war developed. After leaving barracks at Elmira, they participated in some of the early campaigns of the Eastern Theater. And Lieutenant Winslow became Captain Winslow and commander of the battery after Chancellorsville. Now, Winslow later wrote again about what he could and couldn't do here in the wheat field. Quote, I was unable from my obscure position to observe the movements of the troops, and I was compelled to estimate distances and regulate my fire by the reports of our own men and the enemy's musketry. And that's basically how he's figuring out, not only with this noise, but obviously there's got to be a ton of smoke in the wheat field and everything else going on at this point, too. If you didn't know, George Winslow did not survive the Civil War. He died of disease resulting from wounds received in the wilderness in 1864. So he did not even live out the following year.
I find his background somewhat interesting. You know, he's essentially a hardware merchant.
Yeah.
He's in command of an artillery battery. Now, it's one thing to be a hardware merchant and command infantry, cavalry, you know, but artillery, you have to have a specialized set of skills. This is, I think, to be more or less a volunteer in the artillery and rising through, that says something about his aptitude. It's not an easy branch of service to master, and by all accounts, he seems to have done that.
Absolutely right. I agree with you. And probably three other names we never talk about, the commanders of each section with the battery. So we have Lieutenants Crego, Richardson, and Ames, who would have been commanding the left, the center, and the right section here. And again, Ames was killed at Cold Harbor. Richardson received severe wounds later on, which plagued him for the rest of his life. So again, not much long of a shelf life for really any of these guys leading Winslow's battery after Gettysburg.
And once again, when they pass away from causes on other battlefields, we never get to see how they're going to analyze what they did at Gettysburg. Or maybe we'll never write about it. But of course, any chance will forever be ended by that. And this is something that I think adds to a layer of confusion in the wheat field is that the officers are either not long for the action, either killed or wounded, or they're not going to survive the war. So we do kind of have this sort of, at times, these black holes of information, which adds to just the complexity of the wheat field. So we have Winslow's battery in the wheat field. We have the 17th Maine slugging it out with Anderson's brigade. And that's mostly, though, on what we would kind of consider the right section of Anderson's brigade, the right flank. But if you're on to the left, as they are approaching, they would receive, at least initially, a little bit lesser fire as they're moving in. They're going to be a little more covered. They're going to have some protection. But as they are moving forward, when I interpret this phase of the wheat field, there is a moment where I believe that Anderson probably would have seen a situation looks like we might actually be able to outflank the 17th Maine. As that begins to sort of creep into their minds, though, any hopes of that are soon going to be checked as they realize there's now actually Union regiments in their front. And soon you will see a heavy engagement taking place, not only on the right flank of Anderson's brigade, but also in the center and left.
Yeah, that's right. And so as we talked about with the 8th and the 9th Georgia on Anderson's left, we talked about Hillier eventually taking fire on his left and having to refuse the flanks. But let's meet some of the regiments, the Union regiments that they're going up against. So what you're looking at, moreover, I'm going to kind of move from Union right to left just a little bit, down in front of Stony, and I'll explain why I'm doing that. I always do it that way in a minute. But kind of down in front of the Stony Hill area, initially we're talking about the 110th Pennsylvania and the 5th Michigan, all right? And they're going to be hitting the 9th Georgia in particular, but they're probably positioned, give or take, about 50 to 60 yards south of the Stony Hill. They've got the Roses Woods to their front. Anderson's guys are coming through the woods. Now, these guys, too, had also been confronted by stampeding hogs and cattle running through this area prior to the 9th Georgia coming through, and the 110th had to fire a couple volleys that probably killed many of these animals. 110th Pennsylvania, this is part of de Trobriand's brigade, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel David Jones, who will also be wounded. They're only going to have about 152 men on the field here. So when we talk about regiments and you look at a block in a Llano map, it's easy to say, oh my God, these guys have six blocks. They only have four blocks. But of course, that doesn't always really tell the whole numeric story. So you got to look at the numbers, folks. 110th, about 152 guys. Now, they were organized in the Harrisburg, Huntington, and Philadelphia areas.
That's an odd mix.
Yeah.
That's talk about kind of distinct regions of Pennsylvania.
Well, it's
there.
I wasn't going to do the story in the interest of time, but it's funny that you say that because there were some regional resentments that broiled over. And in January of 62, there was kind of a little bit of a drunken brawl in and among the regiment, kind of over control over who was going to have the regimental colors. And apparently by that point, as the story goes, the men had not yet been issued firearms, so they took to assaulting each other with big chunks of limestone broken off from the freshly macadamized National Turnpike, because I guess they were in Hagerstown at the time. So, you know what, Philadelphia, they throw batteries at Santa Claus, they throw chunks of the turnpike at their counterparts in the regiment. To me, it all makes sense.
You know, keep in mind, those soldiers are the great, great, great grandfathers of modern Philadelphia sports fans.
That's right.
So I'm glad to see you. As much has changed in 161 years.
Are we saying that the Philly soldiers started this, not the Huntington soldiers?
That is unrecorded to history. I think we clearly know who started.
We will leave it to the listeners to decide who is to blame for this kerfuffle. How about that?
And so we talked about the low numbers. They've only got six companies here at Gettysburg, and that's why it's such a smaller regiment. But I mentioned the Lieutenant Colonel Jones. He's wounded on July 2nd, and he's going to lose his leg. Very Dan Sickles-like. He's going to unfortunately lose his leg as part of this. So, again, Major Rogers, Lieutenant Colonel, is wounded. He's going to lose his leg. Major Rogers is going to file their report from the battle. And just a quick passage. He talks about getting established in position. He talks about his skirmishers being driven back. Quote, when the general engagement commenced at about 4 p.m., here, Lieutenant Colonel Jones was severely wounded. Command of the regiment was given over to me. The battle continued with a determination on both sides to conquer or die until 6 p.m. when the enemy in our front fell back. The order to cease firing was given. This being done, I was ordered by a staff officer to fall back and give place to fresh troops. Now, of course, when guys do their reports, they telescope events. They leave a lot of details out in the middle, but at least Rogers tells us they're probably in position for about 2 hours, heavy firing, conquer or die, before they were ultimately told to fall back. And, you know, there's one noteworthy story related to this. Private Charles Gardner of the 110th PA was seen by an officer in the 116th Pennsylvania, quote, one young lad laid outstretched on a large rock with his musket still grasped in his hand, his pale, calm face upturned to the sunny sky, the warm blood still flowing from a hole in his forehead. And as some people know, Gardner is believed, and look, I'm using the qualifier believed, but Gardner's believed to be the model for the 116th Pennsylvania Monument, which you can see when you go up around Stony Hill in the loop. We'll cover in the next part.
And makes a lot of sense. They're in the general vicinity there. So,
yep.
So we can't say 100%, but I think air quotes believe, I think that's a fair assessment.
Yeah, it's certainly a descriptive term, at least. The idea that, you know, this peaceful-looking face looking up to the sky and he's got basically a bullet hole in his head and blood flowing out of it tells you, again, a lot of what you need to know about the wheat field.
That's really descriptive. I mean, if you think about what these men write about when they go home, that out of everything that day, that's the one thing he writes about.
That's right. That's Major St. Clair Mulholland.
Right.
Yeah. So we'll talk about when we get to that regiment, but you're right. That's the memory that stuck with him.
And that's out of a guy in the Irish Brigade. That's what sticks out to his head. Right. You know, I'm sure there were things he saw towards the sunken road at Antietam or at Fredericksburg that would rank right up there. But it is interesting as when you read these soldiers' accounts of what sticks out to them in that chaotic situation. Right. You do see that a lot of times in the wheat field, where soldiers, as much as we talk about the confusion, what they don't see,
there's one vivid moment.
Yeah, there's one thing that just kind of sticks out to them, whether it's the guy that was sort of stuck in the mud for Anderson. Now we have St. Clair Mulholland seeing, you know, perhaps this poor soldier. This is, I think, what makes the wheat field so interesting, is that every now and then you get these little glimpses into it that it's fascinating.
Well, you're right. It is fascinating. And I think you see that the Battle of Gettysburg as a whole, too. You know, we need the big picture, because we got to understand what's going on in the official reports and the monument dedications and the Leno maps and stuff like that. But you're right. It's really these small human interest moments, which is what sticks with a lot of the guys afterwards. And you piece it all together, and yeah, that's the story of not only the wheat field, but of Gettysburg.
And it's a reminder that these are real people.
Not resources.
And I think there's a tendency we view this battle almost like it's a game. Mm-hmm. We're moving pieces on a chessboard, and oh, we should have done this or that. Those decisions impact the lives of hundreds of people. And it's not just hundreds of people, it's thousands if you want to extrapolate that out, including their family, their coworkers, all of those. We think about some of these leaders in these units that would have been great, probably community leaders before and after the war. Well, you lose someone like that, that's a big loss to a community. And I think, you know, there's a tendency for us, I think, other than any other battle in the Civil War, Gettysburg gets glamorized more than any of it. I wish we could really lose the hokiness surrounding this battle at times, because I think the hokiness really hides the fact this is just a god-awful human tragedy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the wheat field is maybe the best example of that. There's nothing glorious going on in the wheat field right now.
No, I was in a situation one time, just personal story. I was in a situation one time where, and I'm not going to mention names, but people were trying to recreate dead, you know, some of the dead image, dead body images, which we're going to talk about when we get to kind of the end of this series, but people were trying to recreate it, and they were having fun with it. Mm-hmm. They were laughing and joking. You know, and a friend of mine who was pretty disgusted by all these hijinks was standing next to me, and he said, you know, these guys are not props. These guys are dead.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and you're right. We turn it into a game. We turn it into a scavenger hunt. These guys are dead. And this is a young man with a bullet hole in the forehead kind of thing. These guys are dead. And, you know, we got to remember that. And too often we don't, you know, while we turn Gettysburg into this cottage industry of whatever the hell it is.
The happy place for so many people who visit.
Exactly.
It really was not a happy place.
Yeah, I don't think there's anybody that was anywhere remotely near the wheat field that will describe it as our happy place. And, you know, I wish, frankly, I wish more people gave more attention to Private Gardner than they did quoting the movie Gettysburg.
Yeah, right.
I really wish that.
Okay, so then to the left of the 110th Pennsylvania, yes, we have the 5th Michigan. Now, they are also part of Detrabrian's Brigade, another small unit, only about 216 men here, 109 casualties. So ultimately, we're talking a 51% casualty rate, including Lieutenant Colonel John Pulford, who was wounded. 5th Michigan was organized at Detroit, Michigan, so I want to give a shout-out to my wife and my in-laws, who are from the Detroit area. The 5th was mustered into federal service for a 3-year enlistment in August of 61. Reportedly, when all is said and done, the 5th Michigan had the second highest number of casualties of all Michigan infantry regiments in the war, and of all Union infantry regiments in the war, the 5th Michigan is going to rank 5th in total number of casualties. This is the bloody 5th. This is a unit that, again, is here all through it. They play key roles in a lot of major engagements, including the wheat field at Gettysburg.
And if you would say, okay, hard-fighting Michigan regiments at Gettysburg, who's the first one that comes off people's tongue? It's going to be the 24th Michigan. You think of that. This is a unit that not only is going to suffer heavy losses here at Gettysburg, but for the rest of the war. So I think that's something to look at, too, is we often see we're so focused on what these units do here at Gettysburg that we often don't think about what they do before or after. And this is a great example, just a good, hard-fighting, but probably underappreciated regiment on this field.
Would totally agree. And even Lieutenant Colonel Pulford, as I said, wounded at Gettysburg. That is the 3rd of 5 times he's wounded during the war. And we mentioned in a few minutes ago, these civic leaders. These are the guys who you want around. The guy who's going to stick his neck out there and get wounded 5 times. He's not in back with the supplies or anything like that. These are the guys who are on the front lines.
And I didn't keep track, but we've already mentioned at least a half dozen either wounded or dead commanders.
Oh, yeah.
At least.
I was going to say, can we find a regiment that sees significant fighting in the wheat field that does not lose a field officer or significant company officers?
40 minutes in? Like, not even an hour?
Yeah, we're probably maybe somewhere 40 minutes to an hour into this right now.
Devastating. It really is.
Yeah, it is. It is.
More or less the amount of time we've kind of been talking today about the wheat field. Think about the carnage that has been inflicted just in the opening phase of the wheat field. This is the opening phase here.
We
still have more to go, and that's something to be remembered as well.
Yeah, so as we get to the final phase of the opening phase, as we kind of wind down what we're calling phase one and part two here, there's a gap between the 5th Michigan's left and the 17th Maine's right at the Stone Wall. And for a while, at least, that was filled by elements of Colonel George Burling's brigade. Now remember, Burling's Brigade, another 3rd Corps unit, but now you're moving into guys who are normally assigned to General Humphrey's division. And remember, what is Burling's story at Gettysburg? Burling's story is they basically get pulled away from Humphrey's. They are ordered to go to the left to support Birney, and these guys more or less get parceled out to different parts of the field. That was then the Valley of Death and the Wheat Field, which is going to give us the 8th New Jersey and the 115th Pennsylvania in and around, in between, like I said, kind of in front of Stony Hill and kind of to the Union right of this stone wall.
I always love Burling's account of his experience at Gettysburg when all his regiments are being parceled out. He essentially goes to Humphreys, in his words, more or less, looking for something to do, which, you know, we sometimes don't think about that. You're a brigade commander on a battlefield. His brigade probably sees the most action of a brigade commander who probably saw very little direct action, if that makes sense, that his troops are all over the place seeing heavy action, but not immediately under the direct command of Burling.
Yeah, exactly right. And you think about it, you know, it normally was not Burling's brigade.
Right, yeah.
It was Gershom Mott. Now that's Mott.
There's a great Civil War name, Gershom Mott.
Not to be confused with our friend Wayne Mott's. It's Gershom Mott, singular. But you're right, General Mott had been wounded at Chancellorsville and not returned to duty. Burling, Colonel Burling, normally led the 6th New Jersey, but since General Mott was not back, Burling temporarily had the brigade. Now, Burling was only 29 years old. He was from Burlington County, New Jersey. I briefly lived in and around that area at a different time in my life. But Colonel Burling is, as you said, basically going to lead
have this brigade with no command, and he's going to report back to Humphreys. But I do just kind of want to point out Gettysburg will turn out to be his only major engagement, air quotes, in charge of the brigade. Mott is going to return in August. Burling is going to resign in March of 1864, reportedly for health reasons. And this is what I wanted to point out. December 18th, 1867, Andrew Johnson is going to nominate Burling for appointment to the grade of Brevet Brigadier General of Volunteers to rank for March of 65. The Senate will confirm the appointment in 1868. So Colonel Burling in 1868 eventually does get his star. And I wanted to give him that shout out.
And in some respects, a 29-year-old kind of fill-in brigade commander, that's kind of the guy you'd want to parcel out. I think that's if you're going to parcel out units, that's the guy, because you're not, I don't want to say you're losing a good brigade commander, because we don't know what he would do, but I think you don't probably want to take, say, de Trobriand and parcel his guys out, or other commanders like that have more experience. He's really the right guy to sort of fill that actually important role on July 2nd. Somebody had to be parceled out to fill these gaps.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. And looking at his experience, he's absolutely the guy to do that. And again, how often do people talk about this on the battlefield? Never.
And also the analysis of why things happen the way they do. Yep. We always say Burling gets his guys spread out, but we never think about the why to that, which is what I think we sort of excel at here, is sort of giving that deeper dive and that deeper level of analysis than I think you get in most other places.
Okay, so Burling's got two units in the Wheatfield area, the 8th New Jersey and the 115th Pennsylvania. 8th New Jersey, again, another small one, 170 men, 47 casualties, 28%, including Colonel John Ramsey. Jody, if you're keeping score, another one who was wounded. Now, the 8th New Jersey, they are organized in and around the Trenton area. They were a three-year unit mustered in 61. Next to them is the 115th Pennsylvania. Also small, 151 guys, 24 casualties, because they only have nine companies here, and 24 casualties for a 16% casualty rate, including Major John Dunn, who is going to be wounded. And this is a unit that was organized both in Harrisburg and Philadelphia, another three-year unit. Nine companies, there was no Company H, for any trivia buffs out there who are interested in that one. And they would cease to exist, my little factoid, they would cease to exist in June of 64 when they're consolidated with the 110th Pennsylvania.
There you go.
Nearby. So two of these units will ultimately get rolled in together.
So as this fighting is continuing, we now have the 8th New Jersey and the 115th Pennsylvania now entering into the fight, and they will soon be moving towards more or less that gap between the 17th Maine as well as the 5th Michigan. Mm-hmm. They're going to be moving to, sort of, lack of a better term, plug that gap, and soon that will bring them into contact with the 8th and 9th Georgia.
So there's a little bit of controversy about this.
Yes, there is.
We have not done a lot of controversy in the Wheatfield yet. It's kind of just been more blood and guts and that sort of thing. But, you know, after the war, John Batchelder had a hard time when he was going through and trying to figure out where everybody was and where the monuments should be. He had a little bit of a hard time really kind of figuring out and recreating where the 8th New Jersey and the 115th Pennsylvania were. And in part, Batchelder was supported by critics, survivors from the 17th Maine, who were basically saying, hey, there was nobody to our right, sort of thing. And this idea that were Burling's guys there or not there is one of those positional controversies that does show up in the Wheatfield itself. Look, I think they're there. Mm-hmm. Major Dunn of the 115th Pennsylvania, he says that it was after 2 p.m. They were moved off to the edge of the woods, partly protected by a stone fence. Colonel of the 8th New Jersey were basically there on the right. They're in an exposed position. They build a little bit of a hasty breastwork when the 115th then kind of comes into the zone. So I think what's happening is, you know, my take on it is, and some people have kind of proposed different reasons for this, you know, that the 8th New Jersey and the 115th are there, and then they fall back when they run low on ammunition. I know others have proposed these guys maybe fall back when they see Tilton and Schweitzer coming up onto Stony Hill behind them and they think they're being relieved. It could be a combination of both and that sort of thing. But I do think they're there. I certainly think they're there. You know, we do have to point out, as I've been intentionally reading casualty rates throughout this, who has the lowest casualty rates on this part of the field? It's the 8th New Jersey at 28% and the 115th at 16%. I know there are people out there, I've encountered people who say, oh, no, no, the casualty rates don't mean anything. It could just be luck. No, it does mean something. Mm-hmm. If you take, if you and I get into a fight and I scratch my finger and you get your nose broken, I'm thinking you did the harder fighting. And that's kind of the way it goes. So, look, the casualties didn't create themselves. But I do think the lower numbers maybe suggest Burling's guys are not there as long. They do ultimately withdraw. And one of the things that torques off the guys in the 17th main later is now they're going to have an exposed right flank. They're going to have to refuse some companies. And again, this is the kind of thing that they remembered afterwards. Oh, nobody was on our right. And I kind of think that's
what
happened.
And they've been there the whole time.
Yeah, right, right.
So, I mean, we talk about Anderson being in there the majority of the fight, but 17th Maine has been...
Well, and we look at the numbers. Yes, those are not heavy numbers compared to other units in the wheat field, but it also suggests they were in, having lesser casualties means you're in the fight for a lesser amount of time.
Exactly.
So even though they're only in for a brief period, they're still losing 16% in that brief
and
period.
We're minimizing that.
But yeah, let's not, you know.
No, we're not,
we're not
minimizing that.
But I think also I've often wondered, what were the sight lines like in the wheat field? If I'm on the left flank of the 17th Maine, there's going to be a lot of smoke around me. Am I even going to be able to look off to my right and see units coming onto the battlefield? And if you really delve into a lot of the firsthand accounts of soldiers on the line, not the office, not the generals, but you know, the rank and file, there's often a tunnel vision type dynamic that you get in a battle. You focus on what's immediately in front of you. You're not quite, hey, what's going on all the way over on the right flank? I've got more than enough to handle here.
Well, that's why we exist, though, to combine multiple accounts. That's what historians do. Because you're right. Nobody knows what's going on outside of their zone. Nobody knows that. But that's what we do.
And that's what those commanders are for, and they're dropping left and right.
And like, there is a tendency, I think, to when we read an account, say if you read a more 17th Maine centric account, you go, well, look at these two regiments. They didn't really do very much. Mm-hmm. Well, they did kind of what they were doing. Certainly they're suffering casualties. We know they're there. They probably are not there for an extended period of time, but they are there on the field nonetheless. But it's why I think always take these accounts. I don't want to say dismiss them, but take them with a grain of salt and really kind of consider what the perspective of the writer would have been, not just take it and go, okay, here's this great account. And we see that too many times in the Gettysburg world, is where we just sort of take an account and run with it, and that's that. We don't really analyze it or, you know, really, I think, selectively critique it.
Well, you got to put the whole story together. Yeah. And so, speaking of great accounts, there is a story that people often tell on battlefield tours as the 8th New Jersey falls back. Their colors become entangled in a tree, and the brave fellows got to kind of rally and reform to get the colors out of the tree before retiring under a fairly heavy musket fire. So that's a story that you hear a lot, too, is the colors of the 8th getting tangled up in one of the trees. Speaking of great accounts, I am going to use one because a soldier by the name of Daniel Gookin in the 17th Maine, and I do think when you put the whole story together, I think this kind of addresses some of what we just talked about. And the soldier wrote that he noted in his journal, the regiments on our right had no protection except a rail fence, so they did not stand as well as we did. When the rebels pressed them, the regiments gave way, and this left the 17th Maine's right exposed to a galling fire. And I do think that explains some of it, at least. Mm-hmm. They don't have the sight lines. They don't have the protection. They get pressed. They fall back. And I think that's kind of what happens.
And key word in that whole thing, you said diary.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's written probably within a week of what happens. And sometimes when we look at accounts, I tend to gravitate towards the more recent account to the event, what's the most contemporary. I put a lot more weight on an account from July 4th than I do from one 1884.
And what is the reason for writing? So he's just putting down his personal memories. He's not writing an official report.
There is no you know, he's not writing a letter home.
Right.
He's just writing his journal. This is more of a more or less a private correspondence. And I think that's something you have to look at, too, is the type of account it is and when it's written. And that's the historiography part that makes really a real professional historian, not just someone that's interested in
history. History 101. I mean, I deal with this in the Little Bighorn field. People take stuff from 1926 and they ignore stuff that was written 2 weeks after the battle. They're doing it backwards, you know, kind of thing.
And what certainly would have concerned me if I was in one of those regiments is the Stony Hill off to my right. That's a big honking piece of ground that could, if you're already unsupported, makes it a lot easier for an opponent to more or less outflank
you. Can't see what's coming.
Yeah, they're in a tough spot, and they won't be the first units to be put in a tough spot here in the wheat field. But sometimes it's very easy to go, oh, look at these kind of cowardly units not standing and fighting. Yeah. There's probably good reasons why they did that.
And so we're going to cover Stony Hill on part
correct,
which I guess will be part three of phase two if you're keeping score at home. So to kind of wrap up the 17th Maine, the three and a half companies or so on the right are going to have to refuse their flank now. What was described as a shower of bullets. And while they're doing this, the 11th Georgia is then going to rush them at the stone wall. So we're going to have now some fierce fighting going on at the stone wall at the front and the right. One of the 11th Georgia color guards, Jody, I think you had mentioned this offline, was captured. Mm-hmm. And eventually, though, Anderson's first attack is going to stall, and they are going to pull back through Rose's Woods at this point. You know, as we always say, time is very fluid. What time is it? 5:30-ish? Who knows? But we've been fighting now, I think, probably at least an hour, maybe 90 minutes. Some of the accounts we read suggested as much as 2 hours, but Anderson's going to fall back towards the edge of Rose's Woods to regroup. We've still got our foothold in the wheat field. And folks, that's phase one in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's it. Now, that could be a fight in and of itself right there, but this is just the end of phase one as we are determining it for the wheat field. So
kids, keeping score, how many times did the wheat field change hands in our phase one?
At this point, I did not count a single changing of hands. No.
Exactly, zero. I'm with you.
So through phase one, zero.
The number.
Okay.
Whatever somebody else might say on the Battle of Gettysburg podcast, through phase one, that number is zero right now.
So we have extreme losses and casualties, and we haven't even changed hands.
And it goes back to what I said at the beginning of this. I don't personally care how many times it changes hands. I'm more interested in the back and forth fighting. Mm-hmm. And we've seen fighting at the stone wall. We've seen fighting at the ledge of rocks. We've seen fighting in front of Stony Hill. Regiments come in, regiments fall back. That interests me much more than an arbitrary number.
But I think what we do have right now is a very good grasp of this opening phase of the fight in the wheat field. I think we have laid it out about as well organized as I think you could. And so here we are now. The fight is reaching sort of, as we'll say, the end of phase one. We do have other units beginning to make their way towards the scene, but that's for another episode that we'll cover next time. But for right now, we are sort of at a stalemate, more or less along the stone wall that marks the southern edge of the Rose's Wheat Field.
Agree. Jody, how are you feeling at this point?
Well, I have a grasp on phase one, and hopefully our listeners do too. All right.
Well said.
Yeah.
Well, with that, I think we can probably go ahead and put a bow on this episode here.
Our golden episode.
Our golden, a golden bow
on
this episode.
You know, the champagne. Let me chill the champagne a little bit so we can do a toast to the Battle of Gettysburg podcast before we wrap up our golden episode, as you're calling it.
So before we sign off for the evening, we want to remind you that if you're interested in following us on social media or giving a donation to the show, you can find all of that information in the show notes. We also want to remind you, please subscribe and follow our YouTube page. We are putting a lot of material there that you will not see on the podcast feed. A lot of brand new things as well, so certainly pay attention to that. We also want to remind you about the Battle of Gettysburg podcast store for all of your swag needs. Please check us out there. Books, shirts, cups, you name it. We've probably got it. Baby onesies, if you're in the market for that. I think we even have one of those. So, and as always, the best way to help out the show is to leave us a review on the podcast platform of your choice. But with all that said, On behalf of Jim, Jody, and I want to thank you all for listening. This has been the Battle of Gettysburg Podcast.
Take care, folks.